Blog Talk Radio.
Bay. And tonight, we'll be dealing with the current condition of the United States of America. We want to delve down in that and get into all of the nuts and bolts and wiggle pins of what exactly is the current state of affairs in America. I mean, we just had a man attempted assassination of a man running for public office as president of the United States. And then we have another president, who's current president of the United States, resigning. So, I mean, what's going on in this country? And I have to start off apologizing to you all for a previous broadcast that was set to go on with my special guest, Nicola M. Hurst. However, we had technical difficulties. That's the second time that can happen when our schedule guest on the show. And hopefully if she have time, she can call in tonight so we can hear from her. However, I want to give you my apologies. If you guys were set and ready for the broadcast, it didn't happen. It was because of circumstances beyond my control. However, I did go on, I think about 11 or 12 o'clock that night. I was able to get in and do a broadcast, but that has not been published yet. Okay? Now, we're going to delve down into what we're dealing with here this evening. And feel free to call in. The number to dial into the broadcast is 563-999-3443. That's 563-999-3443. The chat room is going to be open. So you all just hold your hat for a minute, and we'll get that going. And I'm going to go to a quick commercial, and when I come back, then we're going in, okay? So y'all hold your hat, and make sure you got some paper and pencil. You might want to chat some of this stuff down. Okay?
Once again, don't wait until it's too late. Hi, I'm Tahaka. Get out of debt now. Use what you already have at your disposal. Try living in the private for the first time in your life. Go to TahakaDebtElimination.org. What are you going to do when the economy collapses? What are you going to do when life in the public becomes so unbearable you don't think you can survive? There is something you can do now. Gain the benefit now of using the private banking and credit available to you. Avoid the loss of your hard-earned cash with your debt notes. Go to TahakaDebtElimination.org. Request my free report by filling out the Contact Us form, and I will rush the report to your email box. Act now. We still have a small amount of time. TahakaDebtElimination.org.
Okay. Now, I want to touch on some things this evening because I was contrasting some things. We have a country in Africa, and their rules and regulations and guidelines and laws totally prohibit any form of homosexuality. I mean, you go there with it, and they will arrest you. There have been reports of people not only arrested and incarcerated, but some of them have been put to death because of this stuff here. And they sent some information over here to America to let them know that, hey, look, you know, that stuff y'all got going over there, keep it over there. Don't bring it over here because we ain't with it. Now, I want to know whether or not men and women are equal. Are men and women equal? Okay, I mean, we got so much stuff. When I grew up, maybe it existed, but it was not like it is today, to the point where we got to have men bathroom, women bathroom, and now we have to have an alternative. And I've seen situations where one young lady went into the classroom to get her child out of there, and because the teacher was in there teaching the children about the LGBT thing, and this was what went off up in there and threatened to hurt that woman that was teaching the class. And so I have a habit of getting down to the bottom of stuff. Let's get to the bottom of situations so we can come to a legitimate conclusion. Because we got, you know, just like in your Bible, we got religion. Okay. In there it says, well, pray for those who despitefully use you. Well, I'm sorry about that. I ain't gonna be able to do it. If a man strikes you, turn the other cheek. I'm sorry, but I ain't gonna be able to do that. In some kind of way, we are supposed to feel grateful and feel blessed by somebody that supposedly died a most horrible and excruciating and brutal death. So that the people who murdered him can have some kind of blessing. How that sound? Isn't that something? Well, tonight we're looking at the underbelly of a lot of stuff here tonight. Is civil war imminent inside the United States? How bad is inflation in this country? Because I know for a fact, to me, it's devastating a whole lot of people. And for the life of me, I can't understand how a country printing money out of thin air, giving trillions of dollars to other countries, and you got veterans inside the United States homeless and can't get nowhere to stay. This is amazing to me. But nevertheless, we're going to deal with all men and women equal. Y'all hold on a minute. We're going to hear from this gentleman.
Do you believe that men and women are equal?
Honestly. The myths, you know? No, of course not. Who told you they are? You don't believe they are. If it's something that you have to constantly ask about, constantly struggle to achieve and enforce, then it isn't a natural state, is it? If it was an obvious accepted fact, then it goes without saying, no argument is necessary. No one ever says, do you believe that men and women both have arms and legs? No one ever says, do you believe that both men and women breathe oxygen? But you ask, are they equal? Or do I think that they're equal? Do I believe that they're equal? Well, if you believe that they're equal, and you believe that their equality was a natural, undeniable reality, then you would be insulting my intelligence to ask that question. Just as you would be insulting my intelligence if you ask me, Shahid, do you believe that both men and women have arms and legs and breathe air? But you're not actually asking me if men and women are equal. You're asking if I believe that they're equal, which means that you're asking me if I believe in your concept of equality. Well, I don't. It's an incoherent concept. Of course I don't believe that. Men and women are not equal. Men and men are not equal. Women and women are not equal. Individuals are not equal. How can collections of individuals be equal with collections of other individuals? That's illogical. It doesn't make any sense. Are you equal with your boss? If so, then why is he or she your boss instead of you? I'm not equal to another man who's stronger than me, who's smarter than me. I'm not equal to him in strength, and I'm not equal to him in intelligence. I'm not equal to a man who's richer than me in wealth. I'm not equal to a man who has a higher status in society than me. There are things that I can't understand no matter how hard I try, and there's other people who can understand those same things effortlessly. There may be things that I cannot understand, and a woman is able to understand it instantly. Or maybe there's something that I can do that a woman cannot do. So how are you going to extrapolate from those examples or those scenarios that therefore, because Shahid can do something that a woman can't, or a woman can do something that Shahid can't, therefore that means that this gender is superior to that gender or vice versa? Now, you created a concept that is inconsistent, does not align with human reality or human complexity, and you invented that concept because your culture has historically been abominable towards women. The West has never known what to do about women. You went back and forth for centuries trying to decide if women were goddesses or witches, tools of the devil, the cause of original sin. You used to wonder whether or not women even had souls. There's never been any people on the face of the earth so confused and twisted up about women as the West. And then you came up with a so-called solution, which was to create this even more confused concept of equality. And then you'll accuse the Muslim world, and in fact, the entire non-Western world, of being misogynistic and patriarchal, which is what you are. You would accuse the rest of the world for that, because the rest of the world never talked about equality the way that you do. But the reason we didn't talk about equality was because we were never as confused as you are and have always historically been about being humans. And then you try to force us to try to explain our beliefs to you according to your framework. To try to explain to you, for example, how Islam actually upholds the equality of the sexes in terms of both men and women having equal innate value, but they have different roles in society and so on. There's no reason why we need to do this. Why should we try to make our clarity align with your confusion? Why is it even necessary? Why do you find it necessary to believe in the fantasy of equality when we all know that some people are better than others? We all know that some people are smarter than others. We all know that some people are more capable than others. And if that's the case, and it is the case, then subhanAllah, I hope that we're not all born equal, because that would be a severe indictment against anyone and everyone who fails in their life to become an astronaut or to become a brain surgeon or to become a brilliant writer or an artist. If we're all born equal, then how do you explain the infinite disparities between people's capacities? But then you're going to say that all women are equal with all men? When all men aren't equal with all men and all women aren't equal with all women, this is incoherent. What does it even mean? Every person, individual person, is tasked with what their God-given capacities are capable of, and no one is blamed or shamed or looked down upon for not being able to do what's beyond their capacity. And we're not judged on an equal basis, but we're judged according to our individual abilities, whether you're a man or a woman.
But Islam is quite patriarchal, isn't it? I mean, doesn't the Quran say that men have authority over women?
Well, don't they? I mean, men are the ones who have been oppressing you all this time, right? I mean, according to your own narrative, men have been running the show. The feminists are asking for their so-called rights from who exactly? Look, if you didn't have what you call patriarchy, then what you would have is a hell on earth for women. Because clearly, women do not have the power to coerce men, to force men, to make men deal with them this way or that way. If you're out somewhere and a man starts to chat you up and you don't want to be chatted up, what do? You tell him, I have a boyfriend, I'm married, and he goes away. You have to conjure up an imaginary man to get him to back off, because 9 times out of 10, only a man can keep another man in check, because men are inherently more dangerous than women. Instead of patriarchy, replace that word with bodyguard. What makes more sense? For you to be my bodyguard or for me to be your bodyguard? Who do you think is more capable of protecting who? From who? If men didn't protect women, who would? Why, men would do whatever they wanted. And isn't your bodyguard responsible for you? Shouldn't you listen to him if he says, for example, don't go here, don't go there, or let's take this route instead of that route because it's safer? Isn't that authority? But he's doing it for you. Would you feel resentment about that authority? That's irrational. Look, you cannot dismiss the importance of physicality, human physicality. We're physical beings. Technology does not level the field the way you think it does. Let's say you have a business meeting, and you have the meeting in a coffee shop. And while you're there, during the meeting, it gets late. It gets very late. And then the meeting is over. Your phone battery is dead. Coffee shop is closed. The client has left. And you came by Uber. Now you're alone in the dark with no way home. If it's me, I'll just walk home. If it's you, you would have been getting nervous and worried throughout the entire meeting, the later it got, worrying about how you're going to get home. You're not going to be worried about being assaulted by a gang of women. And if you were walking in the street by yourself late at night and you see a man coming towards you, which one of the two of you is more likely to be afraid? Who's going to be scared of who? But see, you in the West have confused this. The feminists have confused this. The red pillars have confused this. This power imbalance with superiority. We don't do that because we don't attach that kind of value to it. It just is what it is. The power imbalance, that literal physical power imbalance, that imbalance in the ability to coerce and exert force and to be violent, is just a fact and a reality of the power imbalance between men and women. But your culture is in love with power. It's in love with force. It's in love with violence. So to you, whoever has the greater capacity for violence, whoever has the greater capacity for being dangerous, then that person is better. The one who can exert his will is better. Whoever has the power to force people to do something is better. And whoever is weaker is less. It's because you admire power so much, and you admire force, and you admire the ability to coerce, that you find yourself resenting that men have authority over women, or the idea, the concept of men having authority over women, because you think it's unfair. You think that women are being deprived. But remove that authority and see how deprived you'll be. Remove that authority and you will be in danger. You will be deprived of your safety. You'll be deprived of your security, your freedom, and maybe your life. In the Muslim world, we're not confused about this. And we don't think in terms of better or higher value on this basis, except in terms of piety and righteousness. And what each person's role is, and what their duties are in society, in the family, all naturally proceeds from their abilities and capacities. I'm not equal to a woman who is more pious than me, but I may have authority over her, because authority does not mean the same thing as superiority. It's just a function. It's just a function that doesn't carry any particular implications about it with regards to value. But your society assigns a value to it that's inappropriate, that is not an obvious value to be assigned to it. You in the West, because you largely become atheist, will make fun of Muslims, will make fun of our intelligence, because, as you say, we believe in fairy tales. You say, we believe in a God without evidence. We have no evidence to prove the existence of God, but we believe in him. Meanwhile, you invent a concept, this concept of equality, and treat it as sacred, and you believe in it religiously, with religious devotion, and you demand that everyone believes in it, and no one can dare doubt the reality and the holy truth of the concept of equality, even though all evidence that you are exposed to on a daily basis disproves that concept. So you'll make fun of us, and you'll look down on us, and you'll insult our intelligence for believing in something that you say we don't have any proof for. Meanwhile, you're believing in something for which all of the proof that exists disproves it. You see how incoherent your thinking processes are?
Okay, we're back, everybody. Now, man said a mouthful. I bet most of us never thought of stuff like that. But you heard the old saying that you can't see the forest for the trees. And what I found out through investigation is that being in this country, it's difficult for us to really, really see things like other people view us. In my opinion, I think other people view us a whole lot different than we view ourselves. They're constantly doing the research and doing the investigation and comparing our society to their society, their lifestyles and things that they do on a daily basis. I got a friend, she's in Cairo, Egypt, and she took a cell phone as she walked through the market and enabled me to pretty much walk alongside. I was able to see just how life over there was compared to over here. Total contrast. The way they dress, the way the men and women interacted with each other compared to how we do it here in the West. In my opinion, we've been led to believe that we are the all to be all, and you know, the greatest, and you know, and that's easy for you to say, but have you been someplace else? Now, I'm not just talking about going someplace to visit. Have you lived in another place? Because you discover living someplace where you get a chance to do things on a daily basis and interact with the culture on a daily basis is totally different than coming in and visiting for 2 or 3 days a week or a couple of weeks. You really get to know what's going on, and then you're able to make much, much better comparisons. You know, I've visited other cities and stuff, but I got a chance to live in Texas. Now, here I am. I'm in Florida now, but I live in Texas. And what I was describing to the brothers and sisters here in Florida when I got back here, they was like, well, you know, I never did experience that. I was in the military. We were stationed out there. And, you know, that's a whole different ballgame. You didn't, you was on the base. You wasn't down in the community, down in the hood. You wasn't there. So my experience was totally different than their experience here in Florida. And the same thing would happen if they came to Florida and lived here in Florida. They'll get a chance to see that there is a difference. And we have a lot of myths going on, a lot of pretense going on in the United States about who we are, what we represent, and what we do. But what we really, really, really need to know is how do other people in other countries view us compared to how we view ourselves? Because, see, there's a lot of things that we do that we consider to be normal. But other people in other countries look at us and say, well, man, that's outrageous. You know, we don't do that kind of stuff over here. I mean, you can't come over here with that. You know, we're not with that kind of behavior. But anyway, I'm going to go to another plug, and after that, we're going to take a quick break, okay? Y'all hold on. Check this out.
I mean, just think about the fact that the fundamental and most inspiring myth of their religion is the story of the betrayal, the torture, and the gruesome murder of the most righteous man on earth, you know, the crucifixion story, and that his supposed willingness to be slaughtered, his willingness to be sacrificed in surrender to the evil of his enemies somehow redeemed his enemies, allowing their evil to run amok, run rampant, and have its way in the world, to the point that the most perfect human being got sadistically murdered. And by his murder, supposedly, the doors of salvation opened up to anyone who believed that he went along with all of that voluntarily, that he didn't resist it, that he didn't oppose it. You know, he didn't so much as raise his voice in rebuke at the injustice. I mean, you can't help but see how this myth has guided or misguided them for centuries, for millennia, in fact, right up until today, and the genocide in Gaza, their most deeply embedded mythology teaches them that the role and the function of the good and the righteous is to be viciously slaughtered, and that by some perverse process, this saves them somehow, saves the ones who slaughter them. Well, I mean, who would reward you for slaughtering the righteous? Who would have ever put that in your mind, that slaughtering the innocent and slaughtering the good was somehow redemptive? I mean, who would have made you think that? This is a serious and really tragic problem for the West, for the ideological and philosophical progeny of Europe, because it's literally coded by now into their moral and intellectual DNA. It's a foundational, fundamental, paradigmatic element in their so-called civilization. And it's crucial to understand this. Look, the whole nature, in reality, the whole nature of the struggle of the human condition is the children of Adam, alayhi salam, trying to prove that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala was right in honoring Adam, alayhi salam. And the other side of that struggle is Iblis trying to prove that he was right in refusing to honor Adam, alayhi salam. This is Shaitan's stubborn, arrogant, and desperate mission from then until now. Until now, he wants to justify and he wants to exonerate himself for his refusal to make sajda when he was ordered to do so, and to prove that he was rational, and that his rationale for that was correct. He's determined to prove that human beings are unworthy, inferior, ungrateful, disobedient, and dishonorable. So therefore, he can't tolerate goodness and righteousness. He can't tolerate obedience and piety and decency in people. He can't tolerate those kind of people existing. Those people must be punished. They must be discredited. They must be persecuted and hated and exterminated. This is the theme of the battle that we're in our life, and it always has been. And Iblis has contrived all manner of ways to accomplish this. And one of the most effective ways that he's used was precisely this twisted concept that I mentioned, where the good and the innocent must be sacrificed. And of course, that goodness ceases to be goodness the moment that goodness moves to defend itself. You see that very clearly in Gaza, in the attitude towards Gaza, because it is impossible morally to blame the Palestinians in any way whatsoever unless you fundamentally believe that the innocent are somehow obliged to not defend themselves and to not resist evil. You have to believe that the good and the innocent are morally required to submit to their own slaughter, just like your myth about Nabi Isa alayhi salam, your myth about Jesus. And if they refuse to succumb to evil, to succumb to oppression and aggression and transgression, then this somehow compromises their goodness and their innocence. Makes no sense at all. It's obviously this is insane. That's sadism, not morality. But it's completely in line with the agenda of Iblis, with the agenda of Shaitan. You see, you can never actually properly understand geopolitics, power dynamics, current affairs, and so forth. You can't analyze any of that accurately if you exclude from your analysis the overarching truth that is conveyed in the Quran and Sunnah, in Islam. You know, this is just another trick of Shaitan, making people think that excluding Islamic understanding constitutes objectivity and impartiality. No, this fatally impairs your ability to recognize and understand what actually goes on in the world. But this, again, is the brilliance of Shaitan in fabricating false religions back in the day. The long-term utility of corrupting the message of the prophets and writing in your own words your own rules and claiming that those are from God, claiming that that's from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because those will eventually be proved false. They'll be proved to be forgeries, and thereby Iblis can sow cynicism and doubt about religion itself and about the prophets and about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala until people think that no religious text is authentic just because they were exposed to fraudulent texts. It's like someone who's been swindled by a con man into paying for a property that doesn't exist. So then they think that no properties exist. It's irrational. But, you know, once bitten, twice shy. And of course, this mindset, this mentality, this really deep animosity towards the good and towards the innocent, and this idea that the role of righteous and pious people is to suffer and be slaughtered, of course, this idea, this concept predates Christianity's spread in Europe. Obviously, they in Europe have the tradition of sacrificing whoever in the society is deemed to be pure, you know, virgins and so on. And there's an abundance of such things in their pre-Christian myths, their pagan myths. And I would argue that the source of this perverse idea has always been the same source, and that's Shaitan. All they did, or all he did, was to Christianize what was essentially his hatred for goodness and decency, his hatred, Shaitan's hatred, for upright conduct and morality, which he then translated for them into this concept of redemptive suffering, redemptive sacrifice, even though his only real interest is the elimination of the righteous, the elimination of righteousness. But you see how this concept runs through their veins, ideologically, philosophically, morally. And then you can see how that manifests in policy. So I'm telling you, you can't separate these things if you care at all about understanding the world accurately, or if you care about understanding the West accurately. You can't do analysis without understanding this. Not proper analysis. They think that their sins are someone else's responsibility. This is foundational for them. And more precisely, that their sins are the responsibility, not just of someone else, but someone else who is sinless, or who is good, or who's moral. The moral are to be redemptively slaughtered by the immoral, and somehow that makes the immoral moral. This is the root, and policies are the branches of their foundational moral confusion. As I said, it's tragic. It's truly tragic, because of course, like anyone else, you have Westerners, non-Muslims, who genuinely want to be moral, who genuinely want to be good, sincerely want that, because that's human nature. That's your fitrah. But it's just like those, have you seen those watermelons that they grow in Japan, that they grow them in cages or in boxes so that they unnaturally grow into a square shape just so that they'll be more easy to, you know, organize on the shelves? It's bizarre. And so in the West, it's the same. You grow them in a whole architecture of philosophical and cultural restrictions that deforms their moral sense. And I'm telling you, you know, you have all of these movements in the West for a return to traditional values and so forth. That's not a solution. That's not going to solve your problem. You are where you are today because this is the only place that your past could ever have led you. The only place that your so-called traditional values could have ever led you. So if you try to revive your Christian past, you'll just be on a loop. Corrupt and confused values, and then a corrupt and confused rejection of those values, and then back again and over and over and over. And that's basically the moral history of the West. That's what's been going on for 2,000 years. Which is why no one in the world agrees with you that you have developed or evolved or changed meaningfully in 2,000 years, because you haven't. It's just like the hands on a clock, you know. As time passes, you just go in circles. Yes, time is passing, but you're not going anywhere. You don't have anything on your bookshelves that can guide you, frankly. You need to try a different bookshelf. You need to try a different library, because all your Western reference manuals will just keep you in that same box of moral incoherence. And no, this doesn't only play out in, say, Western foreign policy, you know, colonization, invasion, occupation, exploitation, brutality, pillage and plunder. This unspoken, unacknowledged, but constantly acted upon hatred for goodness and innocence manifests in many, many ways, not just in, it's not only playing out in Gaza or in Congo or in the global south, in all of the countries that you've ransacked over the centuries, but you're actually slaughtering the goodness of your own people. So it manifests in your own country. It plays out in your own countries. But you're doing it through the ideological word game of freedom and individuality. Because again, everyone in the world can see what you really mean by those terms, by freedom and individuality. You mean license and immorality and amorality and hedonism and heedlessness, impiety and perversion, and basically the murder of any higher purpose in life besides carnal and material self-indulgence. Freedom of this and freedom of that all comes down to basically freedom from moral accountability, which is exactly the same thing as what your ancestors believed in through the mechanism of sacrifice. And it's exactly what is the core doctrine of Western Christianity, except that they believe in it through the mechanism of the myth of the torture and crucifixion of Jesus, Nabi Isa alayhi salam. The right to sin, the right to do evil, being paid for by the persecution of the righteous, or in the modern age, the persecution of the very concept of righteousness. You know, Jesus didn't tell you about freedom. Jesus told you about righteousness, which is almost the exact opposite of freedom if you think about it. Righteousness requires strict discipline. It requires strict restraint or constraints on freedom. But you've made freedom your highest value, which, as I've said before, is exactly like the Satanists. you know, with their single solitary commandment of do as thou wilt. That's your religion, whether you want to admit it or not. And whether you want to admit it or not, it's catastrophic to righteousness, to your own righteousness. And of course, it's just a word game anyway, because none of you are actually free in reality. You're not free in your daily life, and you're not free in your conscience. And this is obvious from the avalanche, you know, the avalanche of mental, emotional, and psychological conditions that's burying your whole society. The people of the West need to be liberated. There's no question about that. Wallahi, there needs to be a liberation struggle in the West, but you and I both know that even if they had some form of a liberation struggle in the West, the only form that that's actually going to take, or that it's likely to ever take, is just a superficial struggle against the ruling elite. And even that is unlikely, in my opinion. But even if they did do that, it wouldn't solve their problem. It's not going to cure your illness. Like I said, it would just be part of the same cycle that they always go through, that they've been going through for hundreds and hundreds of years, leading up to no meaningful improvement. Their revolutions never lead to evolution. And fighting the powers that be would be the same. It'd be the same result. There'd be no positive outcome. No, they need moral liberation, liberation from the moral chaos and confusion. They need to escape that box, that very Western box of moral chaos. You know that story about Pandora's box? Well, that's the box that they live in, a mental and moral container of chaos and confusion and sickness. This is why they literally cannot understand anything outside of their own experience and their own history. Because mentally, they're in a box. Culturally, they're in a box. Psychologically, they think that their history, for example, with a fabricated religion that was only ever used to control people, they think that that means that all religions are like that. They think that whatever experience they have had must be universally applicable. Whatever applies to them applies to everyone. That's what I mean. Their so-called freedom is a farce. They're the most controlled, the most closed, the most narrow-minded, and the most dogmatic people on earth. Not to mention the most miserable, the most neurotic, the most depressed, the most suicidal, the most cynical, and the most hopeless people on earth. I've said it many times. Your civilization has betrayed you. It's let you down. Your so-called civilization is victimizing you and has been victimizing you for centuries. Never mind how much it has victimized innocent people, good people, all around the world for centuries. Never mind that. Never mind the fact that it has been at war with righteous people for centuries. Never mind how it has sabotaged and attacked genuinely sophisticated, genuinely evolved, and genuinely civilized societies for centuries. Never mind all of that. But just look at what it has done to you yourselves. Because for us, in the Muslim world and in the Global South, we've already collectively had enough of you. You know, no one in the Global South or in the Muslim world is holding their breath anymore, waiting for you to correct yourselves. You know, we held out for a long time. Granted, that patience, to some degree, was by necessity because we were your hostages. So all we could do was hope that you would rehabilitate yourselves. But now I don't think anyone even believes that you can. I don't think anyone believes that you can correct yourselves or can be rehabilitated, and I don't think you can either. Not with the ingredients that you have in your pantry. No, those ingredients can only make one dish, and that's the dish that you've been forcing down our throats for all these years. Tyranny and violence and oppression and hypocrisy and white supremacy, racism, colonization, and what have you, amorality, immorality, ruthless evil, greed. You know, you only have in your culture, in your heritage, in your warehouse of ideas and philosophies, you only have the ingredients to make exactly what you already are right now. So like I said, you're going to have to look elsewhere if you really want to change. If you ever want to truly civilize, you're going to have to look elsewhere for some ideas. I'm not saying you can't do it. I'm just saying that you can't do it with the parts that you have right now. You know, it's like if you buy a couch from IKEA, and then when you get the box home and you open up the box, you find that there's only some toothpicks and masking tape inside the box. You can't make a couch with that. It's not going to work. I mean, you can make something with it and call it a couch, but it's not going to be that. So no, as much as non-Muslims dislike it, I'm always going to analyze geopolitics informed by Islam. Because wallahi, trying to analyze the world without this guidance is never going to lead to any sort of coherent understanding, any accurate understanding. And that includes understanding the undeniable role of Shaitan, of Iblis, in Western history, in Western culture, in Western religion, ideology, and then in behavior and in policy. So if you want me to abandon that framework, that religious framework for understanding things, then I know that it's only because you want me to be less accurate in my analysis. And we all know why you would want that.
Okay. There you have it. From a gentleman who is not in America, Mr. Bolson was doing the speaking just then. And tonight we're going to hear from those people who do live in America. But before we get to them, I want to say a few things. Because he was talking about our religion. Because all too often, we adapt. We look at things and try to say, well, okay, that's just the way it is, and we'll adapt to that. When you have people that come from Asia and come to your neighborhood and open up a business, you would think that they would say, well, okay, we're in a predominantly Moorish neighborhood. So in our restaurant, we should find out what these people like to eat because they're going to be our customers so that we can put that on the menu and fix it for them. But they don't do that. They'll come in your neighborhood and bring their food, their culture, their custom, their style, and everything. And as far as they're concerned, you can take it or leave it. Isn't that something? How about that? Think about that for a moment. Just think about that. I can't go into church as a thinking man because a thinking man have questions. And once you start asking too many questions, then you're going to be put out the building. We're going to take a little quick break and do a little commercial, and then we'll be right back, okay? Hold on.
right, everybody. Don't forget, the greatest focal point in your life is when preparedness and opportunity meet. Hello, I'm Tahaka Amana L. Bay. I want to give a shout out to all the brothers and sisters across the country that got our secure parting credit information. It was now officially operating in the private. Keep in mind, you can access the direct treasury account, private banking. Knowing the difference between public and private and being able to function correctly, do that OID. Learn about your 1099s. You can do a whole lot of stuff once you have the knowledge to do so. Go to TahakaDebtElimination.org. That's TahakaDebtElimination.org. Fill out the contact us form. Send it to me and I'll send you my free report. TahakaDebtElimination.org.
Okay, everybody, we're back. Now, the gentleman, Mr. Bolson, he did have a great deal to say about our style and customs and culture here in the West and what we're doing tonight. We are doing a up close examination on the United States of America, the current condition of the United States of America. What is the current state of affairs in America? And keep in mind, the phone lines are open. The number to dial into the broadcast is 563-999-3443. If you have something to say, press 1 on your phone. We'll open up the lines so you can get in. Okay? Now, I want to state some more stuff here about our ability in this country to see things as they really, really, really are and actually think about exactly what is it that you are witnessing or that you are experiencing. Because all too often we just adapt. We say, we're supposed to go to church on Sunday, and the minister is supposed to preach what they're calling the gospel, and during a certain segment, a time period, while you're in there, they'll pass a collection plate around for you to give the church some money. Okay. Well, the church got God. God is all wise and all powerful, all knowing, everywhere, creative, everything. But he needs, okay. And then we have Sister Sophie. She'll stand up and give a testimony that God has blessed her to get the job that she wanted. And then Brother Richard, he'll testify that God has blessed him to buy a brand new SUV that he's been wanting. They attribute these blessings to God. Never mind, there are people in this very country who are homeless and starving to death. But God didn't have time to do anything for them because he was too busy blessing you with a new job and a brand new SUV. That's amazing to me. I had a brother one time. He come on to the job, and I noticed that every day he's putting oil into his car before he goes into the building to go to work. Because during that particular period of time, the oil will leak out, but he has enough oil to drive home and put some more in it, so the next day he's able to get up and go back and forth to work. But he is steady trying to convince me that I need to believe in his God. So I asked him, I said, well, brother, do you pay your tithes to the church? He said, I pay my tithes religiously. I said, do your other members in the church pay their tithes? Yes, everybody pay their tithes. God bless my pastor and his wife to go to Cancun, Mexico on vacation. I said, did he not? I said, what kind of car do your pastor drive? He said, my pastor and his wife have brand new Lincolns. And I said, you pay your tithes? Yes, I pay my tithes. Everybody in the church pay their tithes. So I said, well, he driving brand new Lincoln. You putting oil in a Chevrolet. Why would your pastor or his wife need a blessing from God when he got your money? Why don't you save your money, buy your car, so you won't have to keep putting oil into that junk over there? I think by now you probably bought enough oil to buy a car. But nevertheless, he don't see it that way. He told me, see, I can see right now you going to hell. Wow, going to hell? Well, where is it? I think that's a legitimate question. Where is it? I mean, at least I can put it in the GPS and go over there. And when I get there, I can tell you, you told me where it was, and you sent me over there. But anyway, I'm just talking about how we view things without doing an investigation. We don't invest anything. We just adapt, and we just go along with stuff. The way I see it, I can, instead of me going to the church every Sunday and putting money in a collection plate and giving them 10% of my income every week, so the pastor can ride around in a $175,000 car and send his children to college and live in a $200,000-$300,000 home. Instead of me doing that, why don't I pay myself 10%? And then be able to take that and do something else for myself or somebody in my family or in my community that needed it outside of the church. Well, no, you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to, see, you're not of God. Okay, before we get on with whether or not we are facing civil war in the United States, or if it's a possibility for something like that to happen, I want to deal with something that I have forgotten, but I ran into it the other day, and I think I want to share it with you. We're going to talk about Negroes and guns.
Welcome to 400 Years. In this episode, we'll dive into the remarkable life of Robert F. Williams, a fearless advocate for civil rights and self-defense in the face of racial violence. In the early 20th century, Monroe, North Carolina, was a hotbed of segregation and racism. But Robert F. Williams and his community refused to be victims. From witnessing racism at a young age to his experiences in World War II, Williams' journey was one of resilience and determination. As the president of the Monroe NAACP, he advocated for armed self-reliance to protect against the Ku Klux Klan's terror. His story challenges the prevailing narrative of the civil rights movement, as he clashed not only with white supremacists, but also with leaders like Martin Luther King Jr. Williams' path eventually led him to exile in Cuba and China, where he continued his fight for African American rights. His influence reached far and wide, inspiring figures like Huey P. Newton and Malcolm X. Robert F. Williams stood at the crossroads of nonviolent resistance and armed self-defense, shaping the course of civil rights history. So join us on this enlightening journey as we explore the rich tapestry of Black history and celebrate the resilience, strength, and triumphs of our ancestors. Monroe, North Carolina, Robert Franklin Williams' birthplace, was in 1925, like hundreds of other southern communities, a rigidly segregated town where all levels of white society and government were dedicated to preserving the racial status quo. Black people lived under lynch law. Whites-only signs littered the town, including its library and swimming pool. And black people who dared to speak out were subjected to brutal, sadistic violence. Indeed, it was common practice for convoys of Ku Klux Klan members to drive through black neighborhoods in Monroe County, shooting in all directions. The local white aristocracy, including the Helms family, ran the town. Old Man Helms was sheriff of Union County, whose seat is Monroe. His son, Jesse, became the Ku Klux Klan senator from North Carolina. Helms and the other local racist ruling families kept Monroe safe for Duke Power and the tobacco companies that really ran North Carolina. And for the Southern Railroad now, the Norfolk Southern Company controlled by the J.P. Morgan Banking House in New York. Keeping Monroe safe meant keeping black people down and keeping unions out. North Carolina still ranks lowest among the states in the percentage of unionized workers. In Monroe, young Robert grew up listening to stories from his grandmother, Ellen, a former slave, and tales of his grandfather, Sykes, an advocate for the Republican Party who traveled throughout North Carolina during the Reconstruction era and ran a newspaper called The People's Voice. Before her passing, Ellen Williams entrusted young Robert with the rifle his grandfather had used to defend against white supremacy terrorists at the turn of the century. Early on, Williams encountered racism firsthand. At the age of 11 in 1936, he witnessed a white police officer named Jesse Helms Sr. brutally assault a black woman, leaving her sprawled on the ground. Williams watched in horror as the father of North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms dragged the woman to a nearby jail, exposing her by lifting her dress, reminiscent of a primal act of capturing prey. During World War II, Williams ventured to the North in search of employment. He participated in the Detroit Riot of 1943, a violent event where mobs of white individuals killed numerous black citizens. In 1944, Robert was drafted and served for 18 months in a segregated army fighting for freedom. Upon returning to Monroe, he married Mabel Robinson in 1947 as she shared his dedication to social justice and black American empowerment. After he returned to Monroe in the late 1950s, Williams became active for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP. In Monroe, the regional headquarters of the Ku Klux Klan, Williams witnessed his community denied fundamental rights, subjected to harassment by the Ku Klux Klan, and marginalized within the judicial system. By 1955, the NAACP chapter in Monroe had dwindled down to 6 members. Williams, who had worked as a machinist in New Jersey and did a hitch in the Marines, took over its leadership. He started a membership drive among workers and the unemployed. On too many Saturday nights, KKKers would drive through the black community, shooting it up. Many of these Klansmen came from South Carolina, whose border was only 14 miles away. When North Carolina Governor Luther Hodges did nothing to stop the attacks, Williams and the local NAACP chapter formed a National Rifle Association chapter and trained its members in using firearms. After enduring the situation for a while, Williams became radicalized. Faced with limited options, he began advocating for armed self-reliance as a means of combating white terrorism. Members of his NAACP chapter fortified their homes with sandbags and armed themselves with rifles to protect against Klan aggression. Using military surplus rifles from behind sandbag fortifications, the small band of freedom fighters drove off the larger force of Klansmen with no casualties reported on either side. It appears that the organized armed blacks of Monroe never shot any of their tormentors. The simple existence of guns in the hands of men who were willing to use them prevented greater violence. In the summer of 1957, a Klan motorcade attacked the home of NAACP member Dr. Albert E. Perry. An armed defense squad drove them off. Klan night riding came to a sudden stop in Monroe. This famous incident, which electrified so many black people, was completely suppressed in the big business media. Only black publications, such as Jet Magazine, the Afro-American, and the Norfolk Journal and Guide, reported the event. Another case involved two young black boys, a 7-year-old and a 9-year-old, who were found guilty of rape and sentenced to indefinite terms in reform school after having been kissed by a white girl. On October 28, 1958, a mob of white men in Monroe stormed the home of a 9-year-old black boy named James Hanover Thompson, threatening to lynch him and David Fuzzy Simpson, 7 years old after a white girl told her parents that she kissed them on the cheek when they were playing together earlier that day. Earlier in the day, a group of children, including James and David, were playing together outside when they started a kissing game, during which a white girl their age named Sissy kissed James on the cheek. After the girl mentioned the kiss to her parents, her father grabbed a shotgun and arranged a mob to go to the Thompsons' home, where they threatened to lynch James, David, and their mothers. The boys were not home when the mob arrived, but the police found them shortly thereafter and jumped out with their guns drawn before taking them into custody, where they were beaten by the police. James and David, unaware of why they were in custody, remained in jail for 6 days without being allowed to speak to their parents or any attorneys. On October 31st, a group of police officers broke into the boys' cell wearing white sheets to intimidate them, while white residents of Monroe burned a cross on the Thompsons' lawn and fired shots into their home throughout the boys' detention. Both Evelyn Thompson and Jenny Simpson, the mothers of the two boys, were fired from their jobs. After a brief hearing on November 4th in which they were denied the right to an attorney, James and David were charged with molestation and sentenced to indefinite terms at the state reformatory in Hoffman, North Carolina. These two children, who could have been given the death penalty, were sentenced to 14 years in the reformatory. Only after Williams fought on and protests occurred throughout Europe did the state release the two. Williams began a campaign urging officials to send the boys back to their families and wrote a letter on November 13th to President Eisenhower, who ultimately did not intervene. Finally, on February 13th, 1959, over 3 months after James and David were sentenced to the reformatory, North Carolina's governor pardoned the boys and released them to go home. Neither the governor nor the court admitted to any wrongdoing, and no officials ever apologized to the boys or their families. Several other cases of legal racism convinced Williams that black Americans could not get justice under the then system, and that armed self-defense was a necessity for black people. His organization of armed squads of black people to fight off attacks by the KKK and his militant views had a large impact in black communities all over the country, especially because they proved effective. Williams wrote in his 1962 book, Negroes with Guns, "The Afro-American is a militant because he defends himself, his family, his home, and his dignity. He does not introduce violence into a racist social system. The violence is already there and has always been there. It is precisely this unchallenged violence that allows a racist social system to perpetrate itself." Williams, often dubbed by the press as the Violent Crusader, intended his philosophy of armed self-defense to work in tandem with nonviolent resistance. Instead, that philosophy became the catalyst for a national showdown between two opposing philosophies of the civil rights movement, nonviolence and armed self-defense. Williams challenged not only white supremacists, but also Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights establishment. He and his wife Mabel published the radical civil rights paper, The Crusader. Williams was a counterpoint to the nonviolent philosophy practiced by Martin Luther King. However, he viewed it as self-defense. "When the Klan is shooting at you," he said, "you are justified in shooting back." As a result of this philosophy, the National NAACP suspended Williams for 6 months. Nonetheless, the Monroe NAACP chapter became famous for its militancy and for advocating self-defense against racist attacks. North Carolina authorities were determined to get rid of Williams. They offered him bribes. When that didn't work, they tried to kill him. In fact, on June 23, 1961, a racist thug named Bynum Griffin, the owner of a local car dealership, tried to run Williams off the road. Operating with the complicity of the law, the Klan was unrelenting. On August 27, 1961, freedom riders came to Monroe, North Carolina to prove that passive resistance rather than armed self-defense would defeat the local Klan and improve race relations. But then, all hell broke loose. An armed gang of racist thugs launched a brutal assault on Williams' neighborhood, driven by their hatred for his leadership role in the NAACP. They falsely accused Williams of actively inviting the Freedom Riders to Monroe. In truth, Williams had conflicted views about the Freedom Riders, seeing them as well-intentioned but naive youngsters who were disastrously ill-prepared to confront the hardcore, dyed-in-the-wool violent racists who dominated Monroe County. But they messed with the wrong one that day. A true believer in armed self-defense, Williams and his followers engaged in an intense shootout that sent the Klan bolting. Meanwhile, racists in law enforcement assaulted and jailed freedom riders demonstrating to overturn segregation. By the end of the day, the freedom riders had been bloodied, beaten, and jailed, and Rob Williams was on the run from the FBI. During this assault, the Stegalls, a white couple known for their Klan sympathies, drove through the black community. Only Williams's personal intervention prevented any violence against them. Yet, this action then became the basis of a phony kidnapping charge that was used to hound Williams out of the country. This charge was also used to jail one of Williams's closest supporters, Mae Mallory. In 30 minutes, you'll be hanging in the courthouse square. So spoke A.A. Mawney, the Monroe, North Carolina police chief, to Williams on August 27, 1961. Williams wasn't lynched that day, but he was hounded into exile by the FBI. Williams escaped the FBI dragnet and went to Cuba, where with the assistance of the Cuban Revolutionary Government, he started the anti-racist Radio Free Dixie. Later, Williams would live in China, where he urged Mao Zedong to issue his famous message of support to African Americans. Robert Williams remained a controversial figure for the rest of his life. He built strong relationships with world leaders like Fidel Castro, Che Guevara, and Mao Zedong, and organized international support for the human rights struggles of African Americans. Huey P. Newton, the founder of the Black Panther Party, wrote how Williams' book, Negroes with Guns, influenced him. Malcolm X had this to say, "Robert Williams was just a couple years ahead of his time. Williams had a keen insight into the mind and character of violent Southern racists. In his book, Negroes with Guns, he wrote, "When an oppressed people show a willingness to defend themselves, the enemy, who is a moral weakling and coward, is more willing to grant concessions and work for a respectable compromise." Psychologically, moreover, racists consider themselves superior beings, and they are not willing to exchange their superior lives for our inferior ones. They are most vicious and violent when they can practice violence with impunity. This we have shown in Monroe. Williams also said, "Nonviolence is a very potent weapon when the opponent is civilized, but nonviolence is no repellent for a sadist." Nowhere in the annals of history does the record show a people delivered from bondage by patience alone. Robert Williams wrote two books on his experiences growing up in the South and the racial tensions of the era, Negroes with Guns in 1962, the story of a Southern black community's struggle to arm itself in self-defense against racist, violent white supremacists. And in 1996, he completed While God Lay Sleeping, the autobiography of Robert F. Williams, a memoir of his lifetime experiences fighting for self-respect and dignity. It remains unpublished. Robert Franklin Williams died October 15th that same year in Grand Rapids, Michigan, at age 71. His story is a remarkable chapter in the history of black liberation. Historians have customarily portrayed the civil rights movement as a nonviolent call on America's conscience and the subsequent rise of black power as a violent repudiation of the civil rights dream. But Williams revealed that both movements grew out of the same soil, confronted the same predicaments, and reflected the same quest for black American freedom. Robert F. Williams was one of the most influential black activists of the generation that toppled Jim Crow and forever altered the arc of American history. Contrary to the prevailing narrative that they were hapless victims of violence, black Americans regularly handled business protecting themselves from the KKK and other racists. As Robert Williams's story demonstrates, independent black political action, black cultural pride, and armed self-reliance operated in the South in tension and in tandem with legal efforts and nonviolent protest. This has been 400 years. Thank you for joining us on this journey of exploration into the heroic struggle for freedom and justice. We want to express our gratitude to each and every one of you for watching our videos. We hope it provided you with valuable insights along the way. If you enjoyed learning about Robert F. Williams and the movement for black armed self-defense, please give this video a thumbs up and share it with others who might find it interesting. Remember to subscribe to 400 Years for more exciting topics in the future. Thank you once again for your support, and we'll see you in the next video.
Okay, everybody, we're back. Now, you listen to that. Now, ask yourself a question. How many times during your lifetime have you ever went into a church and heard any pastor mention this man's name? I've never heard it. Now, I have this book in here on the shelf. And I was looking at the cover. I said, oh, man, I need to read about this. But we have what I think has been probably about 2 or 3 months ago. We had a young Caucasian gentleman that came from the other side of town. Nice community, nice neighborhood. He came over into our community with an assault rifle, ammunition, and he went up to the college, and his intention was to just go in there and just start shooting just anybody. And but the security guard was there. He seen him. He took off. Then he goes down to the Dollar General store. He doesn't see any security there. So he goes inside the building with the assault rifle and just starts shooting people. Shot and killed two brothers and a sister, I think. And then when the police come up and trapped him inside the building, they put the gun to his head and shot himself. Now, okay, at this point, we have a real bad situation. So here comes the mayor. Here comes another cabinet member. We got to go over to the church and get the pastor to come. And the next thing you know, Al Sharpton, he done came down here. And because he finna get in the church and we finna preach against racism and stuff. Wait a minute. My question is, where's the Robert F. Williams crew at? Where they at? As far as I'm concerned, I don't hear no preaching about nothing. I want to buy Al Sharpton a plane ticket, put him on the plane, and tell him to get out of there. Send the mayor back downtown, Anna Catlin. We just want the Robert F. Williams folks come on over there so we don't have a conversation and get this thing going. And But see, every single time, this is the situation that goes on down here. We got the pastor, they all on TV. We got to stop all this racism and wrongness. Every single time some crap like this happens, that's what they do. Powder keg about to blow. Here come Al Sharpton to water it down a little bit. You see what I'm saying? Well, what we're doing here today is we are examining the underbelly of the United States of America. And I want to hold this broadcast to get this information out so that we can start looking at things differently. And if you're looking at things differently, you're able to do something different instead of the same old, same old, same old thing over and over and over again. Now, I want to know whether or not civil war is inevitable inside the United States. You think something like that's going to happen? Let's take a look and see what we are facing up, if there's a possibility for something like that happening. After we come back, we'll take a little break, and I'll do another little commercial, and then we'll roll on with this broadcast, okay? Let's see.
You and your family wake up to an emergency broadcast.
The United States is now in a state of emergency.
Riots erupt, statues are torn down, and the government collapses under the weight of escalating violence. Food shortages and rampant looting lead to widespread panic. Clashes between armed forces break out across the country. Would America ever be able to recover from this kind of devastation? What would happen to the government? And how could you survive the chaos? Well, before we answer that, let's rewind and uncover how we got here. We asked ChatGPT to research and predict how another civil war might unfold in the United States. Now, keep in mind, GPT is just an LLM, a large language model. It's not a sophisticated artificial intelligence, so this simulation isn't perfect. But stick around, we'll also share some survival tips for staying alive in a lawless America. If you want to be prepared for this and other not-so-unlikely scenarios, make sure to hit that subscribe button. 6 months before the war, the polarization of America has reached new heights. Political speeches have become increasingly inflammatory, with leaders portraying the opposition as existential threats to the nation's future.
Is America headed for a civil war?
Partisan news outlets amplify the polarization by presenting biased interpretations of events and selectively reporting facts. Making things worse, people only get one side of the story on social media. But we already know that. Algorithms designed to maximize engagement increasingly push users toward content that reinforces their existing beliefs. The period leading up to the American Civil War in the 1850s saw a similar intensification of divisions. And although this time the issue isn't about slavery, racism is still a big part of the growing civil unrest. At this point, the best you can do is to stay informed with a reliable source of news. This means you should also look for media outlets outside of social networks. Try to analyze how both sides are spreading information. As the presidential election approaches, accusations of voter fraud and foreign interference spread like wildfire. Political rhetoric and misinformation amplify distrust in the electoral process, leading to widespread calls for investigations and recounts. Protests become more frequent and more intense. Issues like racial injustice, police brutality, and economic disparities lead to massive demonstrations. And these protests often encounter counter-protests, resulting in violent confrontations. The atmosphere becomes charged with tension as both sides view each other not just as opponents, but as enemies. Pay attention to warnings from local authorities and independent news outlets. Being aware of potential hotspots for violence can help you avoid dangerous situations. 1 week before the war, secessionist movements begin to pop up across the country. States and regions, disillusioned with the federal government, start declaring their independence. Leaders are torn between using force to prevent the breakup of the country and seeking diplomatic solutions to address the demands of the secessionist states. Supporters of secession see it as a legitimate exercise of self-determination and a way to reclaim their rights and freedoms. Opponents view it as a dangerous path to anarchy and national disintegration. During this time of high tension and violence, it's crucial to keep a low profile. Move quietly and cautiously near conflict areas, avoiding sudden movements that could draw attention, or worse, gunfire. As the crisis deepens, divisions within the military and law enforcement become inevitable. Citizens in these institutions begin to take sides based on their political beliefs and regional loyalties. Some units refuse to obey orders from the federal government, while others remain loyal, leading to a fragmentation of authority and control. This means more violent confrontations. For civilians, the division within the military and law enforcement poses a significant threat. The breakdown of law and order now leads to an increase in crime and violence. And with different factions fighting for control, civilians find themselves caught in the crossfire. Familiarize yourself with escape routes and safe zones. Knowing where to go and how to get there if your current location becomes unsafe will become crucial for your survival. As the federal government loses its authority, paramilitary groups and militias begin to mobilize. These groups, often driven by extremist ideologies or local loyalties, take advantage of the chaos to push their agendas and assert control over territory. Clashes between rival groups from the same state become common, contributing to a growing humanitarian crisis. Civilians face displacement, shortages of food, water, and medical supplies. Human rights abuses are widespread. Make sure to prep a basic emergency kit containing everything you'll need to survive. Food, water, and first aid supplies. And steer clear of crowded areas like markets, transportation hubs, and government buildings. All potential targets for an attack. The situation now escalates into a full-scale civil war as opposing sides engage in guerrilla warfare, terrorist attacks, and conventional battles for control of territory and resources. It's an ongoing cycle of violence and retaliation with no clear end in sight. Refugee camps overflow with displaced citizens, and humanitarian organizations struggle to provide aid in the middle of the chaos. Make sure to keep important documents like passports, driver's licenses, and emergency contact information on you at all times. These will be crucial for identification and for getting help in case you're injured or separated from your loved ones. And before you go any further, get a weapon or something to use for self-defense. Even if you're a pacifist, you should be able to fight for your life if necessary. As the conflict drags on, the economic impact starts to show. Businesses across the nation are forced to shut their doors. Supply chains, which once provided a steady flow of goods and services, break down completely. As transportation networks are disrupted and production facilities are abandoned or destroyed, basic necessities are now scarce. The stock market crashes and the value of the dollar spirals downward. Prices for everyday goods skyrocket, placing them out of reach for the average citizen. Unemployment soars as companies face mass layoffs. Those who still have jobs find their wages are now not enough to buy what they need. Communities that used to trust and help each other are now splitting apart, fighting for resources and living in fear. Similarities to the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s become apparent, and Americans face poverty and despair on a scale previously unimaginable. This war could last months or years, and it will be hard to survive alone. Building relationships with your neighbors and community members will be a priority. Sharing resources, information, and assistance will improve the group's chances for survival. The end of active conflict marks the start of an equally challenging phase, the reconstruction. As they celebrate their triumph, the winners face the monumental task of rebuilding a nation devastated by war. Infrastructure is in ruins. Roads, schools, and hospitals need to be reconstructed from the ground up. And it'll be a long road ahead for the government to regain the trust of their citizens. The civil war has cemented the distrust of political leaders and the disillusionment with our institutions. Proving transparency and accountability will be critical to rebuilding trust. At this stage, you should still be prioritizing getting food, water, and medical supplies. Traditional systems may still be disrupted, so explore alternative means of transportation, communication, and sourcing food. The long-term effects of the Civil War will cast a long shadow over the nation. Social, economic, and psychological scars will affect generations. Rebuilding trust, healing wounds, and addressing systematic injustices become ongoing struggles. The new government should promote reconciliation, economic development, and mental health support as critical steps to the nation's long-term recovery. Another American Civil War would be a catastrophe of unimaginable proportions. And while this scenario might be hypothetical, Many people argue we're already living in the first stages of it. The problem is the conflict doesn't necessarily begin and end in the United States. As tensions across the planet continue to escalate, the possibility of another world war seems more likely than ever. How would it unfold? And how could you survive it? Well, check out our video, AI Predicts World War III, right here on How to Survive.
Okay, everybody, we're back. All right, now, you've been giving a heads up. You're looking at the situation that we have as far as politics is concerned. We only have a whole series of things that we're going to have to deal with. And if we don't get rid of these things, then we're going to have a major, major problem on this land here. Number one, money. Number two, religion. Number three, politics. Number four, journalism. Them four things got to go. Okay? Think about it. We're real good. Can't keep doing the same old wrong thing, looking for a different result. That's called insanity. But in a lot of times, we just simply won't wake up. Now, we heard from Mr. Folsom, and who lives outside the United States. He's over there in the Middle East. But what we want to do is we want to see what folks inside the United States, who actually lives inside the United States, and see what he had have to say about some of this stuff. But now, before we go there, I want to talk about this situation that we're currently in at this present time. We got massive inflation. I mean, it's very, very serious. All you got to do is go in different stores and look at the prices. And just think, when you're looking at that price, well, you know, what was that a couple of years ago? See, we have a caller with a hand raised at area code 323 and open up the line. Area code 323, tell us who you are, where you're calling from, and what's your question or comment. You're on the air.
Yeah, my name is Joe from Montana.
Hey, Joe.
And I came here because, how you doing? I came here because The current state of affairs in America, in my opinion, is bad and getting worse. So I called in to find out what people might think of that, what they think the causes are, and what they think the solutions might be. I think the primary cause is corrupt politicians, and I don't have any particular solutions myself.
You still with me, Joe?
Hello.
Okay, I'm still here. Go ahead.
So I feel that's corrupt politicians. We have to get rid of the corrupt politicians, and we have to educate the people. So I wanted to know if there are other people on the line or yourself that have solutions to the problem.
Okay. Well, let me see if there's anybody else that would like to answer Joe's question. The number to dial in is 563-999-3443. Press 1 on your phone, and that'll give me an indication that you have something to say in response to Joe's question. Okay? Joe, until they do that, I just gave you a list of things that we have to get rid of. Number one, we got to get rid of money. Number two, politics. Number three, religion. Number four, journalists. Now, do you know anything about
the
Brits?
You want to get rid of money? You want to get rid of money, and you want to get rid of journalists?
Yeah.
Journalists
That's
are
right.
what's helping to keep the country together. If you have investigative reporters, who are talking about what's going on behind the scenes, they're extremely valuable. Why would you want to get rid of them?
Well, in my opinion, the journalists presented us with information that they've been paid to present us with. But there's a whole lot of stuff that need to be talked about that's never been talked about. For instance, I just ran a club. It's called Negroes with Guns, and about Robert F. Williams and how he dealt with racism and Ku Klux Klan and all that. You know, every year we have so-called Black History Month, and I don't hear that anything about him. I don't hear anything about him in the pulpit with the churches, which is involving religion. I don't have any politician that's standing up telling our people what we need to purchase in order to gather and deal with it, and we don't have any journalists telling us what to do about it. Then we have, when as far as the money is concerned, the United States is printing paper money out of thin air without any gold backing it up, and made it against the law for you to make any purchases with real money, which is silver and gold. So that's my opinion on the situation.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, the fiat money, yeah, and there may not be enough gold to back it up, but you can't get rid of money altogether. Money facilitates commerce, and commerce helps to alleviate war.
Okay. Well, I think we have enough stuff here outside of money that we can use to barter and exchange with one another. And we are talking about moving toward things getting worse and worse and worse. We got veterans that go in other countries and fight wars that they don't know anything about. And when they come back to the United States, they are missing limbs, mentally illness and all that. They can't even get any assistance from the VA. And then we got war veterans suffering from homelessness today. So something is wrong in the society. And so what I'm trying to do here tonight, the title of the broadcast is The Current Condition of the United States of America. What is the current state of affairs in America today? You know, examine it, examine the underbelly, pull out all the stops, and we'll hear what people who live outside of the United States have to say about it. And we also want to hear from people who live in the United States what they got to say about it. We have an open platform here today, and you giving me your opinion, and I'm letting you know how I see it, where I'm sitting.
All right. So what would you do to replace money?
Bottom. First of all, I encourage
you have barter, that means that you have to have the products and the services that somebody else doesn't have so that you can exchange what you've got for what they've got. And if you do that, then you know, let's say you live in Texas and you're growing eggs, and meat. You've got cattle and you got chicken.
Mm-hmm.
But you machined it. But the person who was making the machines lives in Oklahoma. So barter means you've got to find a way to get over there, or he's got to find a way to get over where you are in order to exchange those two particular items. Barter is a very, very cumbersome way, especially if it's going to be for a nation. It's not money that's the problem. It's the love of money and the Federal Reserve, which is the problem. Money helps people to get what they want. And it's a great invention, by the way.
Well, I don't eat meat and I don't eat eggs. I grow trees, fruit trees, and the girl, she grows fruits and vegetables. So we have food and water. It's the basic necessities. And I encourage people to grow your own food. Now, I do have friends in Carolina, lives in Alaska, a friend there in Alaska, he goes out, he spent almost 6 months on the water. He come in, got all the fish he needs. But he called me and said, well, man, look here, I got all the fish you need, but I ain't got no vegetables and I don't have time to grow none. I said, well, I have a brother in South Carolina. I'll hook you up. You send him the fish and he'll send you the vegetables. So we got that working. And I'm down here in Florida and we've been doing this for quite a while. We have brothers and sisters all over Florida that's simply growing their own food.
That's good. Yeah. But if people want to live beyond the edge of the caveman, you have to have money, because you can have taste in one or two things, but you still need electricity, you still need clothes, you still need clean water, you still need machines, you need transportation. And if you don't have money, all of that's going to stop. Just stop. So people can't go from Florida to North Carolina every time they need something different than what they are, than what they already are making. It just doesn't work that way. So money facilitates that. If you go to a supermarket, you have like 10,000 items there. If you go to a store, you might have 500 different items there. If you have barter, you wouldn't have any stores or very few. And after a while, you would have a few that would be a monopoly, and the rest would go out of business because you wouldn't have enough customers going across the United States trying to get what you want. Amazon is a pure example of what money can help people do. You live in China, you live in Spain, you live in the United States. You need something, all you got to do is tap a button and you can get it. If you have the barter, you wouldn't have that type of situation. People would just die if you had a barter system.
Well, you keep mentioning money. Now, when you say money, because here in the United States, it's against the law for you to use money to purchase goods and services. Are you talking about fiat currency, debt notes? That what you're talking about?
I'm talking about anything used for money. You have to have a money system. Doesn't matter the paper money or if it's anything else. If it's something that can be used as currency and as money, that's better than just having barter systems in 1,000 cities in the United States.
Okay, well, but the paper currency that we have is because I ran a test one time. I have a scale in here, very accurate scale, old-fashioned scale with it. Plate on one side and plate on the other. I put a $100 bill on one side and then I put a $1 bill on the other side. It weighed the same. But then I took a penny and put it on the $1 side and the scale moved. So if we took toilet paper, a sheet of toilet paper, and used it as money, I wrote the word money on it, and I could give it to a young lady and said, well, give me a bag of those okra. Right then, I'll take a bag of those potatoes. And here's a sheet of toilet paper. It's got the word money on it. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's fiat money.
Yeah,
it's fiat money. The fiat money is the problem, not money in general. The Federal Reserve, you should do some research into the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is the problem when it comes to money, not money in and of itself. Money in and of itself is a very great institution. You need money in order to have an enhanced lifestyle. Otherwise, people will remain back in the Stone Age.
So you think that the way that we live here in the United States is better than we have with certain isolated tribes in South America, certain parts of Africa, and other places around the world? You think that?
In terms of what?
In terms of, you say, lifestyle and what you were, I guess you were alluding to progress.
Yeah, well, the standard of living in which we have electronics and transportation and machines that help us to do what we want to do, if the tribes and the cities that you're talking about don't have that, then they don't have a good standard of living. Now, if you're going to go and refer to they have a lot of peace inside those tribes, that's an emotional situation, not a standard of living.
Okay, well, we got we got money. We have cars, trucks, automobiles. We have an infrastructure. We have bridges. We have subways. We have airplanes. We have banking institutions. We have so-called educational institutions. But we still have no, it seems that with all of this stuff, we have insanity. We have people who would just go out and take a rifle and try to shoot somebody in the head they don't even know, just out of the clear blue sky, or walk into a shopping mall and just open it up and just gun people down in cold blood in this society. But I noticed that in a lot of the little local tribes and communities, we don't find that. So you're telling me that this is what I need to embrace. Would that be a correct assumption?
No, you're comparing machines with mental illness, and you're probably thinking that the more machines and the more convenience, the more money that's available creates mental illness. Or you may be thinking that since we have a lot of machines, that mental illness will go away. Not one does not equate to the other. If you're going to say that you know a bunch of tribes or small cities where there's very, very little crime, well, that occurs here in the United States as well. It depends upon people's emotional state and the fact that there are airplanes and trucks and boats and elevators and machines doesn't contribute to mental illness.
Well, what does? I mean, we have this in America.
People. Yeah. Huh? Well, people want stuff. They can't get it. Bad parenting, for one thing, a lack of responsibility. The more that people want from their neighbors or from other people, or the worse that they were treated as they were children, the more proclivity they have towards mental illness. Hurt people hurt people. And it doesn't matter if you're rich or poor. If you have bad parenting, you're going to get frustrated and you're going to lash out at people.
Well, we have all that going on inside the United States, and we have money, we have politics, we have religion, and we have journalists and politics. We have all that.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't think any of that contributes to what's going on inside the United States today as far as us? Because I know one thing for a fact. You can have all the money in the world. You can have all the technology in the world. You can have all the transportation in the world. But if you don't have any peace of mind, what do you have? I mean, what good would it do you to have all these things when you are ill, or mentally ill, or physically ill?
That's what I'm saying. if you have mental illness, which can come about with bad parenting, a lack of responsibility, because there are people who are billionaires and they want more. There are people who are poor and they're satisfied with what they're doing and where they are and don't want anything, while at the same time, there are people who are poor and want to commit crimes in order to get what they want, just like rich people will commit get what they want. It's a mental illness, but you can't say that money facilitates it or, well, religion does, because religion is indoctrination and makes people think that there's a God that wants you to suffer for your sins, so that facilitates mental illness as well. If you're talking about the journalists like on CNN that talk about lies, that facilitates mental illness, but those are corrupt journalists. As I stated when I first got on here, it's corrupt politicians. It's corruption. Nothing in and of itself will create mental illness. It's corruption of the mind. When you have a corrupt mind that to begin with, then the other elements that you mentioned will facilitate that corruption, will make you become even more mentally ill. Now, where are these tribes and these cities that you're referring to that have a great lifestyle, they have great peace of mind, and it's a place like a nirvana?
Well, you got tribes all over the world. There are people all over the world who just live in peace. They had a tribe down in South America. Now, these people here, they had never seen in their existence anybody outside of their own people. Never came in contact with any Westerners. Never seen any Spanish, never seen anybody. And these people lived generation to generation to generation. They had children, they had they built their houses, they hunted their food, and they thrived from generation to generation. Never heard of radio, never didn't even know television even existed. Didn't know no such thing about religion, politics, or money. But they thrive and they live and they move and they had their business. And we had gentlemen from the Americas that stumbled upon this tribe over there. And then they began to introduce them to stuff from the West. And these people thought it was fascinating. But soon after that, they noticed that the people, once they came in contact with the people from the West, the tribal members began to die just from coming in contact with what we are calling civilization. What we're trying to do here is just look at the current condition of the United States of America. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to run something past you here. And after we get through listening to this, and we'll bring you back in, and then you let me know what you think. Okay? I'm going to mute your mic. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to move on. We're going to pay close attention to what this gentleman has to say. He is not from the United States, but he's going to give us his opinion on what he thinks about it.
So what are the causes?
That's the thing that I'm interested in. Like when you talk about the Uruguay rounds and trade agreements, the free trade agreements, the, all of these things, and the, even the what do you call it, the World Trade Organization, WTO, the what's it called, International Labor Organization, ILO, all of these things, we know perfectly well that power doesn't take any of these things particularly seriously, except in terms of their the ability to coerce weaker entities, weaker states, but they don't feel themselves to be subject to any of these rules. They're only interested in the implementation of any of the agreements that they've ever signed, insofar as they enable them to enforce rules on everyone else. That's always the weaker party. The weaker party to an agreement. The agreement only exists for the purpose of having a legal justification for coercion, for coercing them, for forcing them, usually for exploiting them, usually for taking advantage of them, even though you're a party to the contract as well, but it can never be used against you for some reason. It can never be used against the U.S. for some reason. I mean, how many World Trade Organization rules has the U.S. broken? When have they ever been held accountable for that? You know? So what I'm interested in isn't the agreements, isn't even like I said, things like debt slavery. Like, for example, I've encouraged and believe it's a good idea for Muslim countries, for countries in the global south, to take advantage of loans, assistance, aid and whatnot, and investment and so on from China. Because I know that China isn't in a position to enforce repayment. That doesn't mean that I think you should just default, but it means that the danger of default won't be held over your head as a method of coercion to make you change your own state policy, your own domestic policy, and how you manage your economy, which is what the U.S. does, which is neoliberalism, which is holding you hostage. China doesn't have the means to do that. So get your money from China, because anyway, China has its own problems, and even the window of opportunity for getting money from China is limited. They have a lot of domestic problems economically. I mean, if you look at what's going on with their property market, for example, they're having a hard time. They'll manage by one way or another. They'll manage, but the extent to which they have, the extent to which they will remain interested in being really active internationally, it may wane. So get the loans, get the financial incentives, get the aid, financial aid, get the investment, get all of that stuff while you can, and you can repay it at your leisure. You can repay it as you're able to, because they don't have a means of enforcement, or anyway, their means of enforcement are limited. So the only thing that concerns me about all of these types of things is what are the methods of coercion that we have allowed to be built up by the West. That they have, like, for example, ratings agencies. Everyone should just laugh whenever a ratings agency puts out its report about who's creditworthy and who's not creditworthy. You should laugh, because that shouldn't matter, but it matters. And we've made that matter to where you can be held hostage by what the ratings agency is going to say, because then lenders will base their willingness to lend money based on what the ratings agency says. Why? But we let them have that power, and then they can say, if you don't repay an IMF loan, or rather, they're not interested. Even the IMF isn't interested in you paying back the loan. They're interested in purchasing your sovereignty. Yeah. So if you don't cooperate with the selling of your own sovereignty, then they can say, well, you're not going to have a good rating anymore, a credit rating anymore, and then you're not going to be eligible for lending from any international institutions anymore, which it means your economy is going to shut down. Any development and any, you know, all of this is going to shut down. These are methods of coercion that we've allowed them to build up, that we've allowed them to have, and that are largely based on our agreement, our willingness to recognize that they're legitimate. One of the big tricks that the IMF does is making it, you have to now prioritize repaying the money that we just gave you. That now has to become the priority, which it just defeats the whole purpose of the loan in the first place. You gave us the loan because we're in some kind of a financial need, because we're facing some sort of socioeconomic crises or whatnot. So we need that money in order to be able to serve the needs of our people to fix these problems. But now, as soon as you give us the money, we have to prioritize repaying you, which means we have to cut down on all of our spending that's supposed to help the people. How does that make any sense at all?
It's predatory.
It's completely predatory. But if we say, no, we're not going to do that, then they have methods of coercion available. They have methods of enforcement to force you. And we should never have. And part of that is, like I said, part of that is from our own willingness to accept the legitimacy of those means. Like, for example, the whole argument that you have to have a certain debt to GDP ratio, and you have to get that down. Why? Why? It's not a household. It's a country. They use that argument all the time, and they use that for austerity, to push austerity. That they try to compare a country to a household or to an individual. That when you're in debt, you have to tighten your belt, and you have to cut your expenses and so on and so on. No, you don't. You're a country. That's what a house has to do. That's what a household has to do. That's what individuals have to do, because we don't have we can't print money in our basement. You can print money. It's a false, as they say, a false equivalency to pretend that a country and a national economy functions the same way as a household budget. It doesn't. It doesn't at all. That's a false comparison. But they convince people to believe that, so that then countries like, say, Egypt or Pakistan or Bangladesh or wherever else, they convince them that you're not going to be able to move ahead, you're not going to be able to accomplish anything until you get out of debt. Meanwhile, they have the whole system rigged to make sure that that never happens. It's impossible for you to get out of debt, because also they don't want you to get out of debt. And they want you to believe that the only way for you to get out of slavery is to get out of debt, instead of just saying, my debt doesn't really matter. If you can just say, my debt doesn't really matter, then you're not going to be in debt slavery. But so you have to see, what are the methods of coercion that are available to the West that make that debt matter? What can they do to force you? And those are the things that you should focus on, not about any agreements and even about patents and so on. What is the the patents on end products? So that if you create a product by a completely different process than what they have, say, in America, say in pharmaceuticals, in medicine, say you create something that does the same thing, but you achieved that, you created that through a completely different process than Pfizer did. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed to sell it.
Yeah.
Because they have a patent on the final product, even if you created a completely different way. Okay, you say so, but I've decided I'm going to do that anyway. So what are you going to do? That's the only thing that you have to ask. What can they do to actually enforce that? Because at a certain point, if you disobey their rules and they don't have a way to enforce it, they'll change the rules.
Right.
Because there's no other way to do it. It's just like what I was talking about in the live stream. You go over and tell China, stop being so successful in manufacturing, in electric vehicles, and in whatever else, because not fair, we can't keep up, so stop. And China says, we're not going to do that. We're going to continue. And then what do? You have nothing.
Yeah, China's going to produce speed trains.
You have nothing to do. So you have to change your rules. Yeah. You have to change your demands. When you don't have any way to enforce those demands, sure, you have to change them, because you don't have any way to coerce. So the only thing that anyone ever has to be interested in is looking at what methods of coercion are available to the one who's making demands of you. That's all. America has become so disconnected from reality, because they're successful domestically at convincing people that narrative is reality, that they really think that they can change reality via pushing a narrative. So they've been pushing the narrative for years now. Belt and Road is finished. China's over. Belt and Road is finished. You can keep telling yourself that. No one believes you. It's just like what they're doing now with Iran. Iran's going to attack. Iran's going to attack. Iran's going to attack Israel. Any minute now. Any minute, there's going to be a massive, unprecedented attack on the territory of Israel, on Israel proper. Iran has not said they're going to do it, but you keep saying, and you're getting so far ahead of it that now even you have the U.S. saying, we've told Israel to talk to us before they retaliate against the retaliation by Iran.
Yeah.
That's for the retaliation. You know, you have to talk to us before you retaliate against the retaliation that hasn't happened yet, because we're just sure it's going to happen. Like, you're just pushing this narrative. And like I said in the live stream, if you are unfortunate enough that you're getting your news just from the West and just from English language media and mainstream English language media, then you'd be forgiven for just hiding under your bed because you think that World War III is about to break out between Iran and Israel. Meanwhile, the rest of the world understands, everyone understands that this is just a trap by Israel to try to get Iran to do that so that they can launch a war. Everyone knows that but you. And you think that everyone is stupid.
Yeah.
And you think that Iran is stupid. And you think that the whole Middle East is stupid. And now you're going around and telling in your headlines that America is asking the Gulf countries, they're asking China, they're asking Russia to talk to Iran, to talk some sense into Iran. So that what? When Iran doesn't retaliate, you can pretend that that's because of your diplomatic pressure? I mean, are you joking? Everyone in the world knows that you're trying to provoke a war. Everyone knows that you're the ones trying to provoke a war. You're provoking, you know, like you can't stop talking about this imagined devastating, you know, apocalypse level attack that Iran is just about to launch against Israel. You can't stop talking about it. And then you want to pretend like you're trying to tell all of Iran's allies, talk some sense into them, hold them back. What? Meanwhile, everyone is telling you when you attack Iran, because we know what you're doing, when you attack Iran, you don't get to use our airspace, and you don't even get to use the bases that you have in our countries.
Take note of that.
That includes the Khalij.
Yeah.
That includes the Gulf. That includes Saudi Arabia. That includes UAE. That includes Qatar. Everyone thinks, by the way, Qatar is like the one that's like the most anti-West or whatever. They have the most bases. Okay? Reality check. But all of them are saying, you don't get to use your bases if you're going to attack Iran. Don't. Not from here. Not on our watch.
Not on our watch.
And Turkey said, you can't use our airspace. So no one is believing your narrative but you people. No one believes it at all. They always try to push that. They think that if we believe it hard enough and we say it enough times, then it becomes true.
For those of us,
but no one believes you. It's very important to understand about them.
Yeah.
It's very, very true about the Democrats. It's true about all of them, but it's very true about the Democrats. It's very true about the Biden administration specifically, that they really think there is nothing. Nothing exists except narrative. That's all that exists is narrative. There's no such thing as reality.
And truth.
At all. And truth. There is only narrative. So that gives you power. That gives everyone power, because the only way that that America can gauge whether or not their narrative is successful is if people in the media, social media, if the population is echoing the narrative. And so no one is echoing your narrative on Gaza. No one. No one is echoing the American narrative on Gaza. You've lost the narrative on that one. And that's when you start to see them changing their approach. Because they don't care about reality, as I said. They just care about the success of the narrative. You've seen now that your narrative has failed. And, you know, the biggest factor in that is the extent to which it is completely contradictory to reality itself. But the other factor is that we have access to reality. You know, and not just because we live in reality, but because social media gives people access to reality. We can see what's happening in Gaza. You know, and then the only other thing that they have to their advantage, and this is a very dangerous thing, really, is short memory.
Yeah.
The population having a short memory. And not knowing context. That's why I talk about that all the time, how important it is to understand the context. Because otherwise, you might actually believe that a strike is imminent from Iran.
Yeah.
You might actually believe that. But if you don't have the context, you'll know it's almost unthinkable that that's going to happen. You know, it's completely unrealistic to think that that's going to happen. And so you should be able, and it's the same thing like with this false claim about Indonesia normalizing. If you have no context, and you're generally speaking, your perception of reality is determined by Western narratives.
Yeah. And to me, hatred for any Muslims.
Well, there's that, but even without that,
yeah.
You would think there would be. You wouldn't think there's a reason for you to doubt that.
No.
You know, if you have no context. And part of the context of that is also knowing again what the source of the news was in the first place. To be able to identify, well, I mean, because sometimes, you know, even in your own personal life, most people, you're able to determine the veracity of something that is being said because you know who's saying it.
Yes.
There's someone who's trustworthy.
That's a good point.
Yeah, there's someone who's trustworthy, and so you believe them because they've been proven in the past to be trustworthy and to tell the truth. But if you don't have, for example, a history of following these events and following the region, then you don't know that this source of news, so-called, is immediately dismissible. Just like you should be able to know that there are certain people, certain Muslim figures online who have spread Zionist propaganda and Zionist lies over the last 6 months. And if you followed that and also followed the debunking of the lies and the propaganda that they have been active in spreading, then you should be able to know, okay, this is not a trustworthy individual. So anything that they say can be dismissed out of hand. But until you've had that experience, you might just believe them because they can sound very convincing. They can sound very informative and they're very emotive. So it stirs up, you know, all of your feelings. But this is the problem of the short attention span, because you might follow what they're saying and the claims that they're making and the allegations that they're making and their accusations that they're making, and then you don't follow it long enough to know that those have been debunked. You don't see the follow-up story that debunks it. It never gets the same attention as the original allegation or accusation.
Yeah.
So if you have a short attention span, you'll never know that it was proven wrong. And then you'll be, you know, embarrassing yourself by continuing to repeat lies that have been debunked months ago, you know. And then you repeating 6-month-old lies that were debunked 6 months ago.
Yeah.
Now it becomes a new allegation and a whole new audience, and it has to be debunked all over again.
Yeah, I was taken aback myself. Last thing this morning, that I forgot about the
claim about du'a.
Yeah,
that you can't make du'a.
Yeah,
in Makkah.
I mean, mainly because I have a friend in Makkah who told me it isn't the case.
Yeah.
You know, Saudi from Makkah.
Well, let me see. This is an important fact, actually. This is an important fact. I know, and you know, that this is not true because we know people there.
Yeah.
We know people who live there, and we know people who go there, and we have brothers and friends and so on who made Umrah, who showed us clips from the Kaaba and from Masjid al-Nabawi during the khutbah at Taraweeh. We know people who go there and we know people who live there, so we have some kind of a connection, which just shows how disconnected you are, that you just believe this without knowing anything and you have no way to check because you're disconnected. You've never been to the Kaaba.
Yeah.
You're someone who's never made Hajj. You've never made Umrah. You know, you've never been to Saudi Arabia. You've never been to Mecca. You've never been to Medina. You've probably never been to the Gulf. But you're spouting off like you know things. You have no experience. But then you're participating in the crafting of a Zionist narrative. And the only way that you can do that is either because you are inexperienced, or you are ignorant, or you are malicious.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Tahaka. You know, there's a difference between what you believe and what you know for a fact and can prove. I live in the private and can prove it. I've exercised my freedom of right to travel and can prove it. I don't have a mortgage and can prove it. And much, much more. And so does many other people across this country and abroad who are secured party and creditors living in the private. Debt is a burden. It causes people a hard time in life. They can't live out live in peace fast enough. Contact me at TahakaDebtElimination.org. You can call me and I'll answer the phone. Leave your email information on my website and get my free report. That's TahakaDebtElimination.org. Get out of debt. It's nothing but a burden. You can't move forward with that. That's a bunch of junk.
Our brother was selected before he was elected. Wait a minute.
What if we told you that Barack Obama, whom many believe to be a symbol of progress for the black community in America, was a puppet by white interests? Many might ask, if he was indeed a puppet, why did the kingmakers choose him? How did he fail to represent black interests authentically? Who was he truly serving, if not black people? Let's find out. The narrative of Barack Obama's ascent to the presidency often carries tales of inspiration, hope, and change. However, beneath this surface, some argue that his rise was carefully engineered by influential figures, the so-called kingmakers, well before the public cast their votes. Barack Obama's election as the first African-American president of the United States marked a watershed moment in American history, symbolizing significant progress in the ongoing struggle for racial equality. His journey to the presidency has been said to not only shatter a formidable racial barrier, but also underscore the potential for inclusivity and diversity in American politics. Yet, alongside these achievements, Obama's presidency also exposed deep-seated racial tensions and challenges that persist in American society. Obama's ascent to the presidency was a triumph celebrated widely within the African-American community and beyond. His victory was not just a personal achievement, but a collective milestone that affirmed the possibility of achieving the highest office regardless of racial background. It represented a culmination of decades of struggle in the civil rights movement, demonstrating that barriers could be overcome through perseverance and a commitment to equality. Central to Obama's appeal was his ability to forge a broad, multiracial coalition of supporters. His message of hope and change resonated deeply, particularly among young people and progressive voters disillusioned with the status quo. His narrative as the son of a Kenyan father and a white American mother embodied the diverse tapestry of American identity and offered a vision of unity amid diversity. However, Obama's presidency was not insulated from the realities of racial prejudice and division. Throughout his tenure, he faced unprecedented levels of scrutiny and opposition, much of which was tinged with racial undertones. From the birther conspiracy theories questioning his citizenship to overt displays of racism in public discourse, Obama's presidency brought to the forefront the persistence of racial animus in American politics. Many black Americans, who had hoped Obama's presidency would signify a post-racial era, were disillusioned by the harsh realities of racial inequality that persisted under his leadership. The rise of the Black Lives Matter movement during his presidency underscored ongoing issues of police brutality and systemic racism, highlighting the gap between symbolic progress and substantive change in racial justice. Obama's mixed heritage and complex identity prompted a broader reevaluation of black identity in America. While he was celebrated as a symbol of unity and resilience, his background also highlighted the diversity within the African-American community. His presidency sparked debates about what it means to be black in America and challenged monolithic narratives of black identity that had dominated public discourse. Moreover, Obama's policies and rhetoric often navigated the delicate balance of addressing racial disparities while appealing to a broad spectrum of voters. His cautious approach reflected the complexities of governing in a racially polarized society, where perceptions of race often shape public policy and political outcomes. So, if Obama was not to signify the rise of the black community, what was he doing? and why was he made president? Key characteristics that made Obama appealing included his popularity, intelligence, and non-threatening appearance to white voters due to his light skin tone and neutral dialect. These traits made him a unifying figure, capable of appealing across racial lines. Comments from Senator Harry Reid about Obama's broad appeal support this theory, suggesting careful planning behind his public image. Obama's early success, notably his Iowa victory, was reportedly backed by Goldman Sachs, hinting at financial motives behind his rise. As a junior senator, his brilliance was seen as a tool for advancing broader strategic goals amid America's declining global power and economic struggles. While Obama's presidency symbolized change, it also raised questions about the influence of kingmakers and whether he could act independently of those who orchestrated his ascent. So, was he selected before the elections? And why really? Here's a reminder to please like and share the video and subscribe to our channel to watch more videos on Black culture, history, civilization, and identity. Let's continue now. The theory surrounding Barack Obama's rise to power asserts that his election was not merely the outcome of the democratic process, but rather a calculated decision orchestrated by influential figures long before his name appeared on the ballot. These behind-the-scenes power brokers are believed to identify candidates who not only possess intelligence and popularity, but also fit specific, often unspoken, criteria. Barack Obama's ascension to the presidency was marked by a narrative that extends beyond conventional political campaigning. It suggests that from the outset of his political career, influential figures within the realms of finance, politics, and media identified him as a promising candidate who could advance their agendas. This notion challenges the simplistic view of electoral politics and highlights the role of backroom dealings in shaping national leadership. The selection process of candidates by these unseen influencers often revolves around characteristics that go beyond public appeal. Intelligence and charisma are essential, but equally significant are qualities like compliance with established power structures and the ability to navigate complex political landscapes without upsetting the status quo. Obama's ability to project a unifying image while subtly aligning with existing power dynamics made him an attractive choice for those seeking continuity with a veneer of change. Central to understanding Obama's appeal was his racial identity and its strategic presentation. As the first African American president, Obama symbolized a historic breakthrough in American politics, a manifestation of progress in the ongoing struggle for racial equality. However, the theory posits that his racial identity was often commodified and strategically manipulated to appeal to diverse voter demographics while assuaging white anxieties about racial change. While Obama's presidency brought jubilation to many African Americans who saw it as a triumph over historical racial injustices, it also sparked critiques about the superficiality of his racial representation. Critics argue that his actions and policies, particularly in areas such as foreign policy and economic reform, often align more closely with mainstream, predominantly white interests than with the aspirations of marginalized communities. Obama's presidency underscored a duality in representation, outward symbolism versus substantive change. While his election represented a symbolic milestone for racial progress, his governance raised questions about the extent to which he challenged or reinforced existing power structures. His cautious approach to issues of race and identity, while understandable in a polarized political climate, left some constituencies feeling unheard and underserved. Critics point to instances where Obama's policies, such as his handling of economic recovery post-2008 or his approach to healthcare reform, reflected compromises that prioritized bipartisan support and economic stability over radical structural changes that could address systemic inequalities affecting minority communities. This pragmatic approach, while politically expedient, fueled disillusionment among segments of his base who had hoped for more transformative leadership. But if he was not elected, who selected him?
Now, all of you know something about kingmakers. When people in back rooms come to somebody who's popular, somebody who's intelligent, that don't speak with a Negro dialect.
Oh,
a light dark-skinned Negro.
Well,
that is non-threatening to white people because they can see themselves in him because he's part them and part us.
This introduces us to a concept called kingmakers. The concept of influential figures, often referred to as kingmakers, orchestrating the rise of political leaders is not new. These shadowy power brokers are believed to operate behind the scenes, exerting significant influence over political landscapes by strategically selecting and supporting candidates who align with their interests and agendas. Kingmakers are individuals or groups with substantial wealth, political clout, and connections across various sectors of society. They wield influence not only through financial contributions to campaigns, but also through strategic endorsements and behind-the-scenes actions. Their goal is to identify candidates who possess the qualities and characteristics that can be molded to advance their specific agendas, which often encompass economic policies, international relations, and broader geopolitical strategies. The process of selecting candidates by kingmakers is meticulous and strategic. It involves identifying individuals who exhibit not only intelligence and charisma, but also a willingness to conform to established power structures and policies favored by the kingmakers. These candidates are perceived as capable of navigating complex political landscapes while maintaining a public image that resonates with a broad spectrum of voters. Barack Obama emerged as a compelling choice for kingmakers due to his unique blend of characteristics and background. His intelligence, eloquence, and ability to inspire were complemented by a pragmatic approach to governance that appealed to both progressive ideals and moderate sensibilities. Moreover, Obama's background as a community organizer, constitutional law scholar, and senator from Illinois positioned him as a candidate with the intellectual rigor and political acumen necessary to address pressing national and international issues. Obama's appeal to kingmakers extended beyond his attributes to encompass broader strategic considerations. His mixed-race heritage and multicultural upbringing provided him with a nuanced understanding of racial dynamics and cultural diversity, a factor that resonated with a diverse electorate and signaled inclusivity in his leadership style. His ability to communicate across racial and socioeconomic divides made him a unifying figure capable of bridging partisan divides, a quality highly valued by those seeking stability and continuity in governance. Furthermore, Obama's campaign platform centered on themes of hope, change, and progressive reform, aligned closely with the evolving priorities of key demographic groups, including young voters, minorities, and progressive activists. His advocacy for healthcare reform, environmental protection, and economic stimulus resonated with segments of the electorate disillusioned with previous administration's policies and seeking a new direction for the country. Now the question is, apart from his intelligence and popularity, what other criteria Obama met that made him the best choice?
It's political scheming, which Senator Reid got involved in. He didn't mean no harm. He was just talking about the white mentality.
Right. That's right.
So now, when you select a man, the man may never know what your purpose was, because I understand that his initial victory in Iowa was financed largely by Goldman Sachs. I don't know the truth. That's what I've read. Now look, who selected a junior senator that hadn't even got his foot wet in the Senate and made him believe that he, from that position, could become president of the United States? I suggest to you that the people that looked at him and saw his brilliance, saw that that brilliance could be used for a purpose that was not our agenda. Now, I'm closing now.
Beyond intelligence and popularity, Barack Obama met several subtle and often unspoken criteria that positioned him as the favored choice among influential figures orchestrating his rise to power. These criteria went beyond traditional metrics of political acumen and public appeal, encompassing attributes that resonated with broader strategic considerations and electoral dynamics. One crucial criterion was Obama's ability to appeal to white voters without alienating them, a delicate balancing act that played a pivotal role in his candidacy. It is suggested that his manner of speaking and his light-skinned tone contributed to making him more palatable to a diverse electorate, particularly white voters who might have harbored reservations about supporting a black candidate. Senator Harry Reid's infamous comments on Obama's appeal to white voters underscored this strategic dimension. Reid reportedly remarked on Obama's lack of a Negro dialect and his light skin as factors that made him an attractive candidate. This acknowledgement, while controversial, reflected broader perceptions within political circles about the strategic value of Obama's racial identity in garnering cross-racial support. Obama's candidacy and presidency sparked debates about the symbolic versus substantive dimensions of racial representation in American politics. While his election as the first African-American president symbolized a historic breakthrough in racial equality and diversity, critics argued that his policies and actions often prioritized appeasing white interests over addressing systemic inequalities faced by African Americans and other marginalized communities. This tension between symbolism and substance was evident in Obama's approach to issues such as healthcare reform, economic recovery, and criminal justice reform. While he advocated for progressive policies aimed at expanding access to healthcare and promoting economic equality, his administration's compromises and pragmatic concessions sometimes fell short of addressing the structural barriers that perpetuate racial disparities. Obama's communication style and messaging were instrumental in shaping his appeal across racial and socioeconomic lines. His ability to articulate a message of hope, unity, and inclusive governance resonated with voters disillusioned with partisan gridlock and divisive politics. His speeches, often marked by their eloquence and optimism, appealed to a broad spectrum of Americans, transcending racial and ideological divides. Moreover, Obama's background as a community organizer and constitutional law scholar provided him with a unique perspective on issues of social justice and democratic governance. His experiences navigating Chicago's diverse communities and advocating for grassroots empowerment informed his approach to leadership, emphasizing dialogue, empathy, and consensus building in policymaking. So, does this mean the black community never won in America? Let's do a comparison of how black people were treated under Obama and before him. Before Obama's presidency, black Americans grappled with entrenched systemic racism, pervasive inequality, and significant barriers to political representation. Historical injustices, such as Jim Crow laws and institutionalized segregation, had created enduring disparities in education, employment, housing, and access to health care. The civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s, epitomized by figures like Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks, made strides in challenging overt racial segregation and discrimination. However, despite legislative victories like the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, racial tensions and divisions persisted. Black Americans faced widespread discrimination in virtually every aspect of life, from segregated schools and neighborhoods to limited job opportunities and unequal treatment under the law. Racist policies and practices, including voter suppression tactics aimed at disenfranchising black voters, were pervasive and entrenched in many states across the country. The criminal justice system disproportionately targeted black individuals, with harsher sentencing, police brutality, and systemic biases contributing to higher incarceration rates among black Americans compared to their white counterparts. The war on drugs policies of the 1980s and 1990s exacerbated these disparities, leading to mass incarceration and intergenerational cycles of poverty and disenfranchisement. Despite the civil rights movement's gains, very few black Americans held positions of high-level political power and leadership at the national level. The barriers to entry into political offices were steep, with systemic racism often hindering black candidates' electoral prospects and policy influence. And what happened during Obama's time?
The people that chose him know the time. That we are living at the end of America's rule as a great power in the world. Now you have to face it. She's bankrupt. What are you going to do when the dollar is worth nothing? They are printing money out of thin air to back these programs. So my brother may be disappointing some that thought he would be what maybe he has the nerve not to be.
Throughout his presidency, Barack Obama and his family were subjected to a relentless barrage of racist slurs, derogatory images, and offensive comments. From depictions of Obama as a monkey to questioning his American citizenship, these incidents shocked and disillusioned many in the black community and beyond. Such overt displays of racism underscored the persistence of deep-seated racial animus in segments of American society, despite the nation's progress towards racial equality. Obama's presidency exacerbated existing racial tensions and exposed fault lines in American society. Disagreements over his policies, responses to racial incidents, and even his mere presence in the White House strained relationships between black and white Americans. Personal relationships, including friendships and professional collaborations, sometimes fractured along racial lines as differing perceptions of racial justice and equality came to the forefront. The advent of social media during Obama's tenure facilitated the rapid dissemination of racist imagery and narratives. Platforms once hailed for connecting people across distances also exposed black Americans to a resurgence of historical racist depictions. Images portraying Obama and his family in caricatures reminiscent of Jim Crow era stereotypes circulated widely, evoking painful memories of America's racist past and generating feelings of vulnerability and unease among African Americans. Despite calls for reform, Obama's presidency saw persistent challenges in addressing police brutality and systemic injustices within the criminal justice system. High-profile cases of police killings of black individuals, such as Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, and Freddie Gray, galvanized public outcry and catalyzed the emergence of the Black Lives Matter movement. While Obama expressed empathy and called for dialogue, his administration's approach to these issues often fell short of satisfying demands for comprehensive reform, leaving many feeling disillusioned with the pace of change. Economic disparities and racial inequalities persisted throughout Obama's presidency, despite efforts to promote economic recovery and social equity. Significant gaps remained in areas such as unemployment rates, access to affordable housing, educational attainment, and wealth accumulation. Critics argued that Obama's economic policies, while beneficial to many, did not adequately address the unique challenges faced by black communities grappling with generational poverty and systemic discrimination. So, it's hard to say that the black community won in Obama's time. Do you think it won? Was Obama representing the black community? Did you ever like him? Let us know in the comment section. Do you agree he was just a puppet? Do you want to watch more videos like this one? If so, subscribe to our channel and press the bell icon next to it. We have decided to bring...
Today in September 2023, the United States is bringing up the student loan thing again. Just like I said they would in 2022. And a lot of people took no action back then. They advertised they would give you a loan to go to school, but you don't receive a check. But anyway, you go for it. The next thing you know, you get a bill in the mail for a loan they said they gave you. And guess what? It has interest attached to it. And as time goes on, it gets bigger and bigger because it was never meant to be paid off. It was designed for you to pay for the rest of your natural life. Get my free report. Go to TahakaDebtElimination.org. That's TahakaDebtElimination.org. Become a creditor instead of a debtor. Get in the private. Get out of the public. Peace. We'll be right back.
right, everybody, we're back. And we're going down to the close of the broadcast. And I think I've pretty much exposed the current condition that the United States of America is in. At least I try to give you this situation from every angle that I could, from people who live in other countries, people who live in this country, some history that a lot of us are not hearing on a regular basis and all this kind of stuff. So the current state of affairs in America, I think, is being exposed to this broadcast here. Keep in mind that we're going to convert this and put it up on YouTube over there. And don't forget to subscribe to my channel over there. You can give me a thumbs up or thumbs down. If you have a comment, go ahead and post your comment. That'll come to me, and I can respond to your comment. And I do hope that you all have got something out of this broadcast. As far as the United States of America is concerned, I think we are in some deep, deep trouble today. Not only economically, but our weather conditions and stuff that's going on across the United States, mudslides, tornadoes, hurricanes, and of course, as soon as we time for the earthquakes start kicking up, it seems to me that the entire state of California is on fire. Every time I look around, something burning over there. And it's just a big ball of a mess. And I'm trying to put this information out so that people can begin to prepare and stop doing the same old that you're doing every day. Get ready. Get your foods and your water. Start getting ready just in case something goes wrong. You be prepared. And the greatest focal point in your life that you're going to prepare this, an opportunity to meet. So if you don't wait until water break out to make ammunition, you get all that stuff now in peacetime. So if something does go on, you already prepared to deal with it. Don't wait till there's a water shortage. Go ahead and stack up on your water. Hold on to your phone. Stop throwing your money away. Grow your own food. Get accustomed to doing that. Just take advantage of every opportunity that you can possibly take advantage of, because based on the information that we have put out here this evening, that should be enough, in my opinion, for us to start, if we haven't started doing this already, is getting prepared for what may come. It's better to be prepared now. You know, get ready now. Don't wait till the last minute, because people do have a bad habit of waiting till the last minute to do something, and then, you know, you're all jammed up and you're rushing and all this stuff. No, you don't do that. Do what you got to do now. You know, just stop partying for a minute. You know, put the party on hold. Start looking at life a little bit more seriously. Pay attention when you go in your grocery stores and stuff. Look at the prices and think, the item that you are looking at, is it worth the price that they're trying to charge you for it? Stop just grabbing stuff and throwing it in the bag. Well, that's what I want right there. I don't care how much it costs. We got to cut this out. We got to start thinking about what we are doing. You know, think. You know, just make change. Change is beautiful. And you see good at night when you know that you're doing something that you're supposed to have done to make things right for yourself. You feel good about it. You know that you have actually done something that you know you're supposed to do to make a good outcome for your future. Now's the time. You know, get out of debt now. Grow your own food. put the movies to the side. you know, start doing something constructive. Take a real good look at your position that you're in right now and ask yourself a question. Okay, am I prepared? Am I ready for what may come? You know, what have I done to put my family in a better life? But nevertheless, I've been your host, Dr. Amana L. Berry, and until next time, y'all have a good day.